Well, welcome, and good afternoon. It's an honor and a great pleasure to welcome Minister Amorim today, a friend of the LSE and, as I'm sure we will see, of global society. We are delighted to have you here. In fact, we are thrilled that you have given up your time to come and speak this afternoon. Your visit to us comes at a very delicate time in Europe and in global affairs. The Madrid bombings are clearly a critical matter, first and foremost for Spain, but with, of course, implications for the rest of Europe and the wider world. But beyond Madrid and the last few days, more widely, the multilateral order faces at least some kind of crisis and is in some kind of disarray. I think for at least four reasons. First of all, the promise of the trade talks at Doha came to an end, really, or stalled at Cancun. The trade talks matter, above all, for the world's poorest countries, so they might have a free and equal footing in the global economy. And yet today, many countries are signing up bilateral and preferential trading agreements with each other, and the world's poorest countries remain relatively marginal to the world economic system. The Doha talks are stalled. Secondly, the Millennium Goals. We might call these the social standards or the moral consciousness of the international community, the minimum standards of the global economy. It seems as if now we may not have been necessary for us to define them. So far are we from their realization. We are moving in many respects on a different road to the realization of the Millennium Goals. Thirdly, global warming after Kyoto. If the first two reasons should not give us pause for thought at global warming and Kyoto, the British chief scientist, Sir David King, has recently said that global warming poses a greater threat to humanity than global terrorism. Well, irrespective of whether we agree with that or not, the polar ice caps are melting, species are dying, and the challenges of global warming are pressing down upon us very seriously. And fourthly and finally, of course, Iraq and the fallout of Iraq with its impact on the UN system and the wider framework of the international community. We are in danger, I think, for these and related reasons of losing sight of one of the crucial lessons of the post-Holocaust world, which is that we must have, by necessity and because also it is desirable, a fair, rule-based, multilateral order. Now, against this rather bleak and dark background, leadership clearly matters. And so we are particularly pleased that you speak to us today on the foreign policy of President Lula. Let me say something briefly about Minister Amorim before we begin. He is the Brazilian Minister of Foreign Relations. In fact, this is the second time, I understand it, you have held the post. He has worked as a diplomat for nearly 40 years, including as the Brazilian representative in the United Kingdom, and he has held many other posts besides, at the WTO in Geneva and at the UN. In addition, I should mention, of course, that he was lucky to be a student at the very finest university, if not in the UK, then if not in the world, then certainly in the UK, here, of course, at the LSE in 1968 to 1971, where he was a student, among others, of Ralph Miliband. I thought too late that it would be fun to try and dig out the records of our minister at that time, because if you were a student here in 1968, you must have got into some kind of trouble at one time or other. But alas, I had that idea too late, so I couldn't read an embarrassing line or two from your old student records. Anyway, we welcome you very much to the LSE, and please help welcome me a very warm LSE welcome.
Professor David Held, I think you already touched on so many subjects and aspects, I don't know if I'll be up to the task. But I'm really touched to be with profound emotion here today. There's a long time I haven't seen this room as full, certainly not with me in this side of the room. Of course, when President Lula was here recently, it was very full, but it was not this room, it was another room. And so it reminds me of the times of what we might say the roaring 70s, where the room was usually full, but very often for other reasons, to challenge the authorities of the time. And of course, my good friend, Ann Bohm, who was in a way responsible for my getting into the school, knows what I mean. You won't find my files because they have been probably burnt in all these, in all the agitation of the time. But it's also of great, a reason for great emotion for me here to see so many good friends, Eric, Marion, Tony, Anne, to whom I referred already, and I'm trying not to enumerate because I'll be missing some. Also, I want to make special tribute to our ambassador here, Ambassador Bustani, who, of course, you know, is an international figure on his own right, by the way he guided the Organization for Chemical Weapons Convention, and he had to pay a high price for that. But I wish to thank you all for your presence and express my satisfaction at being able to be present, to present to you Brazilian perspective on current international challenges. As President Lula indicated when he spoke to you on July 2003, the London School of Economics is held in very high esteem in our country for its tradition for independent thinking. Many in Brazil have drawn inspiration from the work of LSE professors and scholars. As a young diplomat, and to use Rolf's expression, a bit reckless diplomat in London, I was a postgraduate student at LSE and benefited greatly from the intellectual vitality and social responsibility which are the hallmarks of this institution. The name of Rolf Miliband stands out in my mind amidst other distinguished intellectuals, as a political scientist and as a human being. To me and to many of his students and admirers, Miliband represented this unique blend of idealism and pragmatic thinking that were at the very origin of LSE. And I wrote this passage, Marion, before I knew that you were here. So it's part of my most sincere feeling, and I'm very proud to be a friend of your Miliband and of the family. I feel greatly honored to be here today. Last July, you had a first-hand account from President Lula himself of Brazil's determination to implement a program of change capable of placing our economy on the path of sustainable growth with effective income distribution, job creation, and social inclusion. You are aware of the special attention we attribute to the fight against hunger and extreme poverty at the national level. I need not elaborate on Brazil's commitment to democratic rule and responsible governance. My task as Minister of Foreign Affairs is to reflect these values and priorities in our relations with the rest of the world, in accordance with President Lula's vision of a more democratic, cooperative, and humane international environment. It might be said that in many respects my position is enviable. Respect for President Lula's personal leadership has opened many doors to representatives of the Brazilian government worldwide, in the North and in the South. As I have often observed to journalists in Brazil and elsewhere, the demand for President Lula's message is greater than the supply of Lula. In every country I have been to, and I have traveled widely during these months, I have found much sympathy and support for the policies and the spirit of the Lula government. No doubt, Brazil under President Lula is touching many hearts and reaching out to many minds. At the same time, I am under no illusion that we will continue to face an uphill battle in our diplomatic agenda on crucial areas, such as making international trade less tilted against developing countries, from agricultural subsidies to intellectual property constraints on cheap medicaments, mobilizing resources for the attainment of the Millennium Development Goals that were just mentioned by David, and reducing hunger and poverty in particular, strengthening real and effective multilateralism, and promoting more representative and democratic decision-making at the global level, from the UN Security Council to the G8, establishing social justice and respect for international law as the foundation for the enhanced security and lasting peace. In Latin America and other parts of the developing world, we have been suffering for some time now the social consequences of policies unsuited to our circumstances. As pointed out in the recently published ILO panel, International Labour Organization panel report on the social dimensions of globalization, the new emerging consensus is that globalization has not lived up to its promise. It has failed to improve the livelihood of most people in the developing world. In many quarters, it has made social problems more acute. As Joseph Stiglitz, who I saw here, speaking from here in this podium, said, if we wish to stem the growing, in one of the Miliband lectures, if I'm not mistaken, if we wish to stem the growing tide of discontent towards globalization, we must promote more inclusive debates and focus more on the social agenda. This implies reviewing some of the new liberal assumptions and prescriptions about minimizing the role of the state and a blind faith in the ability of market mechanisms to produce the changes needed to make the world socially more fair and politically more stable. Thanks to a comparatively benign domestic evolution, Brazil has been spared the serious social turbulence that has affected many of our neighbors, from Ecuador to Argentina, from Venezuela to Bolivia. But this has only made us more sensitive to the interconnectedness between our own destiny and that of our fellow South Americans. As I have stated several times, if we fail to integrate healthily through increased trade and investment, and if we don't join our forces on the basis of our shared democratic values and cultural affinities, we may have to resign ourselves to the perverse integration of illegal armed groups, organized crime, and drug trafficking. What I want to say by that is that there is no alternative to South American integration. The real alternative is whether we'll have a healthy integration or if we'll have an unhealthy one. Clearly, we must assume our individual and regional responsibility in the search for new and more balanced policies. We must preserve the political achievements since the end of the military rule in the 70s and 80s. But we must also improve the lot of our people. In Brazil, we have been working hard to defeat disillusionment and promote renewed faith in our ability to work together within South America and beyond towards common prosperity and stability. The cornerstone of this effort of integration has been the bilateral relationship with Argentina. The broad convergence of views between Presidents Lula and Kirchner on the most pressing issues confronting us has been expressed in the Buenos Aires consensus adopted in October last year. This document reflects our common aspiration for economic growth with social justice and manifests our determination to transform the Mercosur trading bloc, which also comprises Paraguay and Uruguay as full members, and Bolivia, Chile, and now Peru as associated members, into a catalyst for building a shared future. The meeting that has just ended in Rio between the two presidents, Lula and Kirchner, confirmed once again this commonality of perception, while fully recognizing that the particularities of the situation of each country. Successful negotiations with the Andean community, with the three other Andean countries of the Andean community, Colombia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, set the stage for a common economic space, capable of heralding a new chapter in our integration efforts in the continent. If we add to these initiatives our growing links to Guyana and Suriname, the emergency of a South American community of nations does not look like a distant dream. The importance of this process does not exhaust itself in the expected trade benefits and increased economic ties. More frequent and intense contacts among governments in the region will help us in our struggle against crime, drugs, and illicit trade. It will increase our political unity and strengthen our negotiating capacity vis-a-vis other more powerful nations and groups of countries. Most of all, it will help in intensifying the people-to-people contact in an era in which restrictions based on concerns about security or illegal immigration tend to erect barriers between countries and whole regions. Over the past year, all South American heads of state and government have come to Brasilia on official visits. In each case, they were accompanied by several ministers, allowing for fruitful, result-oriented talks on wide-ranging programs for cooperation. President Lula has been to most of our South American neighbors at least once since taking office. I'm in touch with my colleagues in the region on a frequent basis. Just to illustrate, I have been 5 times to Peru and 3 times to Colombia in the past year. I have stopped counting the times that I have visited our Mercosur partners. This is all unprecedented. Past governments had vowed to attribute priority to South America, and important steps were taken. In practice, however, we had more people working, for instance, on the free trade area of the Americas than on strengthening Mercosur. We were less inclined to think creatively about Colombian conflict, for example, than to react to plans designed by others. Today, we have revived Mercosur, concluded trade agreements with almost all other countries in the continent, and become actively engaged in the not always easy search for stability in Venezuela, Bolivia, Colombia, in a spirit in which our traditional attachment to non-interference in internal affairs of others is tempered by what I like to call non-indifference. South America is therefore our first priority. But let me touch upon other aspects of Brazilian foreign policy. In so doing, I would like to distinguish between 2 sets of cases. On the one hand, situations that are part of the international agenda irrespective of our will. On the other hand, our effort to reshape the international agenda itself, albeit in a limited way, with a view to creating a world more conducive to international cooperation for peace and development. The security challenges stemming from September 11th and the current Iraqi crisis clearly fall into the first category. International terrorism is at the forefront of international agenda, whatever we may think of its causes or of the most effective way of coping with it. It concerns us all, whether our countries have been directly targeted or not. To Brazilians, the death of our compatriot Sergio Vieira de Mello and his colleagues at the UN headquarters in Baghdad stands as a painful reminder. As I speak today, we are still under the shock of yet another heinous attack against innocent civilians in Madrid. Brazil has been pressing for enhanced international cooperation to combat international terrorism at two levels. Firstly, to carry out repressive measures against terrorist organizations and organized crime through judicial agreements, intelligence sharing, closer contact among law enforcement and police institutions, everything in accordance with multilateral precepts and international law. And secondly, to promote tolerance, democratic values, and greater attention to terrorism's social and economic roots. In joining forces, we should take into account the vast body of international law at our disposal and work multilaterally, mainly through the UN system, but also through regional organizations to improve our preventive capacity. By contrast, the idea of preemption, which has come to the vogue, seems to be to create as many problems as it seeks to resolve. Without entering into detailed debate on the matter, I would venture to say that in the absence of a multilaterally negotiated approach, the concept of preemptive military action to forestall imminent threats will never enjoy international legitimacy. Beyond that, I would only like to underline a very important concept. The whole structure of the United Nations system to deal with force and aggression is based on 2 different aspects. One is enforcement, and enforcement requires international approval. The second is legitimate self-defense, which of course in some cases has to be individual. And one of the main problems of the doctrine of preemption, the way it has been presented, it is that it merges together these 2 very different aspects of the international peace and security structure of the Charter. And when I say that we should pay attention to multilateral aspects, I am referring mainly to the United Nations Security Council. As President Lula has stated before the UN General Assembly, and I quote, "A world in which the use of force is not based on agreed multilateral rules and understandings will be intrinsically unstable and structurally insecure." In the first months of 2003, President Lula took a series of initiatives in order to, even if we were rather distant from the conflict, in order to contribute to a diplomatic solution to the Iraqi crisis. On the basis of a set of ideas floated by the Gulf states, he kept in touch with Secretary General Kofi Annan and the Security Council members with a view to obtaining Iraqi compliance with the international obligations while still preserving the authority of the Security Council and hopefully a peaceful solution. Even after the war was initiated, President Lula persisted in his diplomatic efforts, which included contacts with the Pope John Paul II. Today, we remain concerned with the level of violence in Iraq and more broadly in the Middle East. As the first Latin American head of state to speak before the Arab League, President Lula made clear during his stay in Cairo last year that Brazil stands ready to participate in any renewed diplomatic effort towards peace in the region. With this objective in mind, we will shortly be establishing a diplomatic mission at Ramallah, and I will be appointing a special envoy to the Middle East. We also intend to reopen our embassy in Baghdad as soon as Iraq recovers fully its sovereignty. As the country with the biggest number of people of Arab descent and a dynamic and highly influential Jewish community, both living peacefully side by side, Brazil thinks it can be of some assistance in efforts that have been deployed by the international community while fully recognizing the complexities of this task. In parallel, we are responding constructively and I hope also creatively to Kofi Annan's invitation to look at contemporary threats to peace and reshape collective security. These imply looking at two interlinked aspects of United Nations reform. On the one hand, enhancing the capacity of the Security Council to confront the current challenges to international peace and security, among them those posed by terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, and on the other hand, imparting the necessary legitimacy and representativeness to the Security Council so that it may carry out its enhanced responsibility with greater effectiveness and broader international support. The outcome of the discussions of the so-called Blue Ribbon Panel and the Secretary General's auspices will help us to hopefully will help us focus on a new compact among United Nations member states. We have before us a historic opportunity to preserve and strengthen collective security in a context which has been aptly described as, and I quote, no less decisive than 1945 itself when the United Nations was founded, end of quote. We are prepared to take up this challenge, and this is a matter which I intend to pursue in my contacts here, in the Foreign Office, as well as elsewhere. A reformed Security Council with new permanent members from the developing world, has become an urgent necessity. In the economic sphere, President Chirac's initiative to promote and expand the dialogue between the G8 and the emerging economies from Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which happened in Evian last year, is a step in the right direction. We hope his example will be followed and may lead to more permanent arrangements that in which the voice of those of the South are also heard. As we continue to strive toward these goals, we remain acutely aware that their attainment depends, to a large extent, on a more forthcoming attitude on the part of key actors in the developed world. But we remain optimistic. To our mind, all those genuinely committed to democratic values must join in the effort to promote more democratic decision-making processes at the world level. Just as history has taught us to mistrust the false idol of autocratic efficiency, we should be wary of dispensing with the search for consensus within multilateral frameworks. Instead, we must work together to perfection existing mechanisms and develop new ones. Unilateral actions may appear to bring speedier results, and this may well be the case, but most of the time they are short-lived and lack legitimacy. Of course, that does not mean that Brazil will hesitate to act individually or in coordination with like-minded partners to promote vital interests relevant to humankind as a whole. I will refer to two of them, which are in fact interlinked: combating hunger and ensuring that developing countries are provided with a level playing field in international trade. In many ways, these projects involve a certain reconfiguration of the world's commercial and diplomatic geography, to use President Lula's words. The same impulse which leads us to strengthen our South American unity can also be found in other initiatives, such as the IBSA, the newly established India-Brazil-South Africa Trilateral Forum that came to be known as the G3, bringing together three great democracies of the South, one in each continent, the G3 can play a useful role as a magnet for cooperation among developing countries and as a force for dialogue, which is different from confrontation, with the rich North. In the same spirit, we have been coordinating a group of 20 agricultural exporters from the developing world, the G20, which made its appearance at the WTO ministerial conference in Cancun as a voice in favor of freer trade in agriculture and against the billions spent on trade-distorting agricultural subsidies. It is not an exaggeration to say that the G20, for the first time in trade negotiations, brought home a twin message of trade liberalization and social justice. Hunger, which affects one-fourth of the world population, of which 300 million are children, has been described by President Lula as the biggest and the deadliest weapon of mass destruction. According to UN calculations, as many as 24,000 individuals a day perish due to hunger-related causes. At a recent gathering in Geneva, with the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan and President Chirac of France and Lagos of Chile, President Lula took the lead in proposing a new international drive to combat hunger. And we note that the leader of the Socialist Party in Spain, which just won the elections, Mr. Zapatero, also said that he wants to join this quartet and make it a quintet. He will be, of course, welcome. The objective is to raise financial resources to invest in projects in areas such as agriculture, health, and education. Several ideas and initiatives have been put forward, both as to how the resources should be tapped and as to how they should be better used. In addition to a facility established last year by Brazil, India, and South Africa under the UNDP program, other proposals deserve to be examined and made operational. In this context, we welcome very much Chancellor of Exchequer's Gordon Brown's idea of an international finance facility that would anticipate, through a system of bonds, the materialization of the commitments made by donor countries in relation to the Millennium Goals. It's President Lula's intention to organize a meeting of heads of state and government immediately before the opening of this year's UN General Assembly to take stock and plan ahead. The other aspect of fighting poverty. The WTO round of trade negotiations launched in 2001 raised legitimate expectations for a more development-friendly trading environment. Of central importance was the possibility of bringing agriculture into the mainstream of multilateral trading system, thereby putting an end to the regime of exceptions and waivers that protect inefficient producers in rich countries and castigate competitive exporters from the developing world. At the WTO ministerial in Cancun, coordination among a representative group of developing countries with a special interest in agriculture succeeded in preventing attempts to dilute the ambitious Doha mandate. The G20, to which I referred already, and which includes countries like Brazil, India, China, South Africa, Argentina, and others, represents 22% of the world agricultural production, but 70% of rural workers and 60% of the world population. Last December, the G20 met again in Brasilia with the Director General of the WTO and also with Commissioner Lamy of the European Union. And we hope that new meetings will soon take place with other groups as well as with the United States in Geneva. As has become apparent, in other important trade liberalization exercises such as the FTAA, Free Trade Area of the Americas, the World Trade Organization remains the principal forum for tackling trade issues such as agricultural subsidies and anti-dumping rules. Let me give you another example of what I mean by reshaping the international agenda. When President Lula took office 14 months ago, the FTAA negotiations had been proceeding under a framework which was highly imbalanced and unfavorable to Brazil and Mercosur. Issues of priority concern for us, such as agricultural subsidies and anti-dumping rules, had been set aside. under the pretext that they would be better dealt with in the Doha round, while overambitious commitments, disproportionate even to those under consideration in the WTO, were being sought in areas such as intellectual property rights, government procurement, investment rules, as well as a framework for trading services that departs from the WTO one, the famous General Agreement of Trade and Services. All these would impact directly on our latitude to promote development-oriented policies. Thanks to a collective effort, a compromise was struck, which allowed us to rebalance the negotiating framework at the Miami Ministerial Conference last November, setting the stage for mutually beneficial outcomes based on what a free trade area should really aim at, that is, access to markets. Before concluding, I would like to refer to our relation with Europe. In Brazil, we consider the current Mercosur-European Union negotiations for the conclusion of a trade agreement as strategically important. In addition to the potential commercial gains and strengthened economic partnerships at stake, is the notion of ensuring a healthy multipolarity in our trade relations with the developed world. Indeed, if we don't have economic and commercial multipolarity, there will be no political multipolarity. Our trade with Europe is growing at a much faster pace than that with other parts of the developed world. At the political level, we have been experiencing a new and increasingly vibrant dialogue with individual countries in the European Union as well as with the Commission. I have not only been regularly in touch with Pascal Lamy, but have had fruitful talks on a wide range of issues with Commissioners Chris Patten and Javier Solana, who will be coming to Brazil next month. President Lula has developed close ties with a number of European leaders, including Prime Minister Tony Blair, with whom he had the opportunity of exchanging ideas on progressive governance last year. I have referred to President Chirac's amplified G8 dialogue last year in Evian, which included, of course, Brazil, and his participation in President Lula's project on fighting hunger. Spain is the second largest investor in Brazil and a strategic partner in Europe. President Lula has visited Berlin and Lisbon and remains in frequent contact with the leaders of many other European countries, including Chancellor Keller of Germany. In many respects, Europe represents a model and an inspiration for our own integration efforts within Mercosur and South America. I am certain that both regions will greatly benefit from increased economic, political, and cultural ties. For my part, as a former ambassador to the United Kingdom and as someone who owes a lot to this country and in particular to this institution, I retain not only a professional but a personal interest in developing relations with our British counterparts in all fields, diplomatic, economic, cultural, educational. I am thus very happy to be in London for a busy agenda, which includes probably as one of its highest points, I cannot compare with others not to elicit jealousy, the stimulating gathering at LSE, but also contacts in government, including with Foreign Secretary Jacques Straw, the press, and the private sector. So I thank you very much.
We have plenty of time for questions. I would just like to say one thing, though. At the end of questions, when I bring questions to an end, can you please remain seated till the minister has left? And then, of course, we wish you a very good evening after that. I usually take questions in clusters of five, so the audience has a chance to raise a diversity of views right from the beginning. But please keep your questions brief. Upstairs is showing lots of hands, so please. Perhaps you could just say who you are and then ask your question. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Karenia Olandia, and I would like to make a question. It's about the neighborhood, if it could be said like this to South America. How can we analyze the relationship between between Brazil and Venezuela? It is possible to say that the President Lula is ideological link with President Chavez? Thank you.
Hello, my name is Klaus Dahlgaard. I'm a student at the LSE. I have two very brief questions. Firstly, in Brazil's ambition to secure a permanent seat at the United Nations Security Council, given the Security Council's debacle before the Iraq War last year, would you agree or disagree with the statement that having a permanent seat in the Security Council is not that important? What is important is the relative power of states, especially for Brazil, in the international society. And secondly, when you hinted at the Mercosur following the European Union's model of integration, are there any plans in the near future to create anything more than an economic community, for instance, a political union following the European Union's model? Thank you.
I'm Teresa Tadem from the Philippines. I want to know what role you see the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank play in combating poverty and hunger in Brazil.
I'm Casper Henderson from opendemocracy.net. Two very brief questions. Do you see a role for a Tobin tax type arrangement to help fund the hunger program in addition to the International Finance Facility? Are they complementary? The second question, a little more, if you could, on relations with the US and specifically opening, you talked about opening markets on the FTAA. I wonder if you could give us more on that because you didn't talk much about the States.
Well, the bad precedent has been started since some of you are sneaking in two questions, one question each, and brief.
This is just a comment. Thank you, Professor David. Welcome, Minister.
Brief. And your question
is? Such a big country, but I'll be brief. Okay.
It doesn't matter. You can still ask a short question.
The position in the Security Council, of course, it's very urgent, so that it will be expanded and the United and the whole, and it will be very transparent. Who has to decide, Minister? See, the American administration is unreachable even to their closest allies. If at all you assume that Brazil, India, and South Africa get into them, how could you persuade them? See, at the one end, there is a terrorism.
Well, my intervention was clearly
global warming.
Well,
how
pointed.
Could you persuade them diplomatically?
Your question is sharp.
Position,
of course. We've got your question. Thank you so much. So, that's the first cluster.
I'm not sure I've got the question. I got the dissertation, but I'm not sure. Anyway.
Well, that's the first cluster. If you could just have a brief set of answers, then we'll go to the floor again.
Okay. Well, Venezuela, Brazil-Venezuela. Of course, our relations with Venezuela have been good in different spheres, economic, political, and so on. We understand that Venezuela has been undergoing for some time difficult period. We don't take some risk here in saying things that maybe should not be said in public, but my impression when I visited Venezuela is that not only the political body is divided in Venezuela, but the society is very divided in Venezuela. And that, of course, reflects on the difficulties of bringing together the two sides to find a constructive solution to the problems that Venezuela faces. We have done our best to help. And I think when the government of President Lula came to power, the situation of confrontation in Venezuela was acute. And the solutions that we're offering there, in my opinion, maybe wrong, I don't know, in our opinion, would only aggravate the crisis and create an immediate confrontation with no probable result in sight, certainly not from the point of view of the government, but also not from the point of view of the opposition, given the relation of forces. So what we tried to do was by creating this group of friends, which was led by Brazil, but included other countries with interest in Venezuela, was to help to reinitiate a dialogue that had stopped there. And I think we were successful to some extent because although we are facing problems now, I don't ignore it, we had 1 year in which the tension was to some extent diffused. Although sharp lines of division were still there, of course, very harsh rhetoric on both sides, but in which we were able at least to channel one possible solution, which was the one that is foreseen in the constitution in of Venezuela itself, which was the recall referendum. Well, in order for that to happen, it was necessary to have the collection of signatures. This took place, and we tried to use whatever persuasion we were able to use to ensure that these would run smoothly. We, I think, had some role, I must say, in helping in the invitation for international organizations, the OAS and the Carter Center, to be there. Now we face a new crisis, and every day there is a new aspect of the crisis, so it's very difficult. And I must say that as I was leaving Brazil, there was the decision of the Constitutional Room of the Supreme Court, whose implications I have not yet the political and legal implications I have not yet fully analyzed. But it's clear that in Venezuela we don't have an ideal situation. It's clear also that Venezuela underwent a crisis such as the attempted coup d'etat of 2002, which were real. These are not imaginary. This is not imagination of President Chavez. That was a real thing. There was an attempt to topple a constitutionally elected president. So, and this is something that you have to take into account when you see the whole situation in Venezuela. So without commenting on this last decision and how it will be implemented, what we were thinking before that, and that's what we have been talking, for instance, with the Carter Center, is that although it's not the ideal situation, and the ideal situation very often doesn't exist in many countries, rich and poor, is that there could be a remedy if the verification process that was established in principle by the Electoral Council, could be implemented in a transparent way, so that people would have real time and real facilities to express their view. You may argue, well, it was not probably necessary to have that because you could already gather the intention of the voter, even if some of these planillas, the data were filled by the same handwriting with different signatures. Okay, it might not be ideal, but, you know, as I have said to some people before, in Brazil we had the impeachment of a president. In that case, it was decided on the Congress. But if I had at that time to vote, to put my signature, I would put one, two, three times. So if there are people who really feel very strongly, they would go there again, and I think there is a remedy for the situation. Whether there will be enough signatures or not, we cannot know. Whether even having the signatures, if the referendum will prove contrary to Mr. Chavez, is something that we don't know. What we do know is that there is this very strong division in the Venezuelan society, and I think that is something that's probably not the creation of the present government. That has been developing for quite a while, and I think we have to think in terms of the future of building bridges so that this division does not... I say that because I lived when I was a young man, the Goulart government in Brazil, and right and left were very divided. But it was nothing like what we have, what I sense in relation to Venezuela. So there is a need for really maybe some further development. But it's up to the Venezuelans themselves to find their ways. It cannot be imposed from outside. Whatever we can do, and that's what we try to do with the group of friends, is to create appropriate conditions for a dialogue among the different sectors of the Venezuelan society. Second question and the fifth one are linked, is the question of the Security Council. First, let me say one thing, and I don't want to sound disingenuous and to say that we are uninterested on that. Of course, Brazil is interested. You might know that when the Charter of the United Nations was still being written, Brazil was seriously considered to be one of the permanent members of the Security Council. And there were actually two leaders who opposed that. One was Stalin, the other was Churchill. And I think for different reasons. Stalin thought that we were too much pro-American. Churchill probably thought the balance should stay more in Europe than go to other continents. So it's nothing new, at least in relation to Brazil. And it would be, as I said, disingenuous to say that we're not interested. But what I would stress is that the need to reform of the reforming the Security Council is not so much the need to be agreeable to the aspirations of this or that country. It's the need to make the Security Council a more legitimate and therefore a more effective organization. Well, it has been said that in the Iraqi question, it didn't prove to be effective. I think we have to work on the two fronts. We have to work on the fronts of strengthening the Security Council in terms of its own action and making sure that important decisions that affect peace and security go through the Security Council, and on the other hand, make it more representative, because that will also help to have more support to its decisions. So I don't think it's a separate question. I think the two questions are interlinked. If you want to make it more effective, you have to make it also more legitimate. It's not an easy task, but you know, easy tasks normally are not interesting ones. So this is the one that we are. IMF and World Bank combating poverty and hunger. Well, I understand the task of the IMF is not really to combat poverty and hunger. The important thing is that its rules do not prevent us from combating poverty and hunger. And so what President Lula has been saying alone, and yesterday there was a joint communique with President Kirchner, but also President Lula had spoken to the then Director General, Managing Director of the IMF, and also to several of the leaders, and I think he talked also to Tony Blair, in relation to the IMF, is that certain investments, special investments of infrastructure, some of which are of a profound social, have a profound social impact, should not be considered as pure expenditures, but as investments that in medium term will actually make our finance and our surpluses more sustainable. Because that's what we don't, and when we speak of sustainability here, and that's one point that I've been stressing when we discuss with other leaders in relation to other countries of our region, you have to think not only of financial sustainability, but you also have to think of political sustainability. Look at what happened in Bolivia recently. It applied very faithfully the rules of the IMF, but the government just couldn't cope with the social situation. So we have to learn to cope with these different things. The World Bank in the past has been an important supporter of programs in Brazil. One of the problems that we have with the World Bank today, not with the World Bank specifically, but with the multilateral institutions today, is precisely how their investment and their financing of our own investment is calculated in terms of public deficit. Because what happens today is that, for instance, in the second or third months of this government, the president of the Inter-American Bank, a good friend of ours, Iglesias, came to Brazil and offered $2 billion, but we just couldn't use, because our limits, the limits of our public surplus would make it impossible for us to use. So again, this is some area in which we're trying to change the rules, and there is a reference to that in the joint communique of President Lula and President Kirchner, which was issued yesterday in Copacabana, which is a good place, I would say, to start changing the world. Tobin tax. Well, let us forget the name, because the name has got so much flack already that it may not be helpful. But when President Lula and President Chirac met, also with President Lagos and Kofi Annan, they referred to several possibilities of new sources of resources for combating hunger, which again I described with President Lula's word, the deadliest weapon of mass destruction. And there are several ways. One would be something similar to the Tobin tax. I think the Tobin tax was more related to short-term capital. And you can consider short-term, but you can also consider other kinds of capital flows. For instance, capital flows that go to tax havens and that might be useful even to make it more difficult to have money laundering and things like that. You could also have, as it was mentioned, tax on certain transactions on arms. But there are also other ideas, such as the one that I mentioned by Gordon Brown, of somehow creating a market mechanism that would anticipate the fulfillment of the commitments of the goals of the millennium, which is also a very creative idea and I think should be explored. So I don't think there is a monopoly of one idea in relation to these. I think there is the question is really putting together. As I speak now, I think that there is a working group in Paris, which is a result of the meeting between President Lula, President Chirac, President Lagos, and Kofi Annan, which will be discussing some of these possibilities. I think that's all.
Well, we have time for one more round and five more questions. So let me start down here. At the back there, right behind you. Turn around. Where's the mic? Straight up, yeah.
Thank you. Brian Henrahan from the BBC. I heard Pascal Lamy last week talking at a meeting. He was asked about Cancun, and he said he was surprised at the G20 resisting the inclusion of services and intellectual property on the agenda on the grounds that the alternative was to leave it to direct negotiation, bilateral negotiations, presumably with the United States, which wasn't a very good idea. I wonder if you could tell me what you think of that as an answer, and perhaps you might also comment on the merits of the argument itself.
Good afternoon. Sarah Salmon, Food and Drink Federation. I just have a question about WTO. Given a lot of the studies that have come out recently saying that Brazil stands in many ways to clean up from further rounds of trade liberalisation at the expense of least developed countries and countries currently benefiting from colonial preferences, given Brazil is a supporter of the development round, would you agree perhaps that there should be some formal recognition of the difference between advanced developing countries and least developed developing countries in the next round?
Bill Brett, Director of ILO London. The Minister mentioned the ILO-sponsored report on globalisation. There have been many reports from the UN in the last 10 years. Most of them have gathered dust and no action. How can we take forward this report, which many of the ideas which have been mentioned in this meeting, and ensure it doesn't gather dust for the rest? Would the Brazilian government be prepared to be one of the sponsors to ensure this is, there is an international debate on these issues?
Hello, my name is Isabel Garcia Nevet. I'm a student here. I'm from Venezuela, so I have experienced personally the whole polarization you were talking about. I'm just wondering, I mean, how far does this polarization have to go before the countries, members of the group of friends, take a stronger stand in front of the position, the situation in Venezuela? Thank you.
Boa tarde, Sigona Munin. Oliver Henman from Oxford University. How far do you think the model of participatory democracy, the participatory budgeting pioneered in places like Porto Alegre, how far do you think that will be a part of Brazil's foreign policy now in terms of democracy promotion? Thank you.
That's five questions. Let me just slip in one from the chair. Let me ask you a question in the form that you are perhaps able to answer. How important is this upcoming election in the north, in the United States, do you think, in global affairs for the next year or two? I'm not asking you to choose between candidates, just saying how important in your judgment do you think it is? And related to that, what do you think the main differences in foreign policy are between the two candidates, and should we worry about that difference? To put it in more academic terms, we had a wonderful visitor here recently from China who looked at American foreign policy from a Chinese perspective, and they said from China's point of view, what's more striking about American foreign policy over time is its continuities, its not its differences, that most of the precedents that Bush has followed were created in the Clinton era, and so on. So does this election really matter? Do the differences really count? Come back at that at the end.
Well, no, maybe
we'll answer it for
maybe
you.
Maybe I start with that, because I think I would be more interested in hearing your own opinion. because it may help my foreign policy than giving my opinion, which may be detrimental to my foreign policy. So, but taking up your last, and you have our future ambassador in Washington here, so I have to be doubly careful. But whatever way. But let me just comment, take your last comment, because I think this has part of the answer. I don't know if it's the full answer, but part of the answer. I remember here I was a student of with several people, because I followed classes as well in international relations. I still remembered Dr. Baum saying, sending a letter to me that saying that I was more interested in political theory there, but she said, you may qualify for international relations, if at all. So, but I remember Professor Northedge, who was a great professor also, saying, and he has a book called The Foreign Policy of the Powers. And he tried to show how the foreign policy of the Soviet Union was very similar to the after at least some tremblings in the beginning, very similar to the foreign policy of the Tsarist Russia. So if that is so, a Democrat or a Republican might not show that difference. But of course, it's always, for whoever is, for a historian, it may not matter, but for whoever is living a situation, details matter. But it's an important election, but I won't say which will be the best result from our point of view, you can imagine. Pascal Lamy. Of course, I would not say that my good friend Pascal is misinformed. So I would have probably to say, very much contrary to what my high regard for the BBC, that the BBC is misinformed. Intellectual property is not up for discussion in the Doha round. As a matter of fact, it was part of the Uruguay round. And what we have been trying to do since Doha, was to have some provisions made more flexible so that our policies in relation to generic drugs and treatment for HIV/AIDS could be put forward. So it's not really a matter for the round as such, intellectual property rights. There is the question maybe related to that of, how do you call that again, denominations of origin, but they give a different name now, geographical indications, which somehow is, but it's not really intellectual property in a way. It's another way of seeking to make the most of what you have done in the past and not to look much to the future. But anyway, that's another matter. The other point of services, we are not against discussing services in the WTO. We are prepared to make an offer. Of course, we'll measure our offer for what we are able to get in areas of our interest. And the difference I would make between the WTO and the talks in the FTAA is that in the WTO, we are talking under a structure that is already defined, which is the structure of the General Agreement of Trade and Services. And we are quite prepared under that structure to make offers. Whether they will be attractive enough or not, it's another matter. But whether the agricultural offers will be attractive enough also, it's another matter. But we are able to negotiate. And the same way you are negotiating between Mercosur and the European Union bilaterally, and probably to go a little beyond what we do in the WTO. In the FTA, it has been different, because in many of the agreements that the United States got with other countries in the region, and some of which are being still proposed, the structure is not the same structure of the GATS, of the GATT Agreement on Trade and Services. I give you an example. I'm sorry to get too technical, but I think that may be interesting for those of you who are economists. One of the modes of delivering services is so-called mode 3, is the right of establishment. That means that you go to a country, establish yourself, and produce the service there. Well, in our opinion, this has to be treated, as in the WTO, as a kind of service. Therefore, subject to the rest of the rules that apply to services in the WTO. In the FTAA agreement, in some of the agreements with Chile or other countries, the United States got or obtained to treat this not as service, but as investment. And because investment has no framework, of course, the conditions for the discussion of this item has been totally different.
So we are open to this, coming back to your question, we are open to discuss service in the WTO according to the model of the WTO. The degree, the amount of the offer will depend on what we receive. Least developed countries. We are quite prepared to recognize the difference between countries like Brazil, Argentina, China, whatever, and least developed countries. That's no doubt. But let me put you one thing. The argument has very often been presented not in order to improve the situation of the least developed countries, but to create obstacles to the developed, to the other developing countries. And I must tell you that the great majority of the poor people, including of the, those who live in extreme poverty in the world, live in developing countries by the simple fact that they are bigger. So you have to take this argument with a grain of salt. We agree to take obligations that we are not demanding from least developing countries. Actually, we'll, during the UNCTAD meeting in June, we'll start, June or July, I don't remember, June or July, which will take place in São Paulo, we'll start negotiations of preferences between developing countries. And we are quite prepared, in many cases, to give preferences without any reciprocity to least developed countries. That's actually how we have been acting to a large extent in the negotiations in South America, in which we have not asking any reciprocity, but we are offering liberalization in a much speedier rhythm than we are demanding. So we do recognize these asymmetries, and we would hope that rich countries would treat us the way that we are treating the least developed countries, or even less developed countries in our region. Lord Brett, you certainly had a great participation, a big participation in the report. Is Brazil prepared to lead? Well, you know, there are different ways of leading. I didn't analyze yet, let us say, with a lens, all the aspects of the report to say, well, let me make it mine, let it make it Lula's report. But I agree that many of the points that the report tackles are also points that are essential to us, that have been essential in Brazil, in Porto Alegre, to which you know Lula is very attached to, and to his own message about social equity, combating poverty, limits to globalization, or at least qualifications to globalization. So I think to a large extent there is a coincidence, and there will be leadership. But we don't want to steal Mr. Somavia's thunder, of course. Participatory budgeting in foreign policy. I hope I could participate more in the budget in Brazil, and I'll give more budget to the foreign policy area. But what we are using most of all is participatory budgeting as a kind of best practice examples. And for instance, I mentioned very in passing that last year Brazil, India, and South Africa, among other things that we did together, we created a facility in the UNDP. And it was to give an example, because three very poor countries, each one gave $100,000 or so, plus what President Lula had got as a personal prize of the Asturias Prince, plus what Brazilian companies put. So the fund, although it's modest, already has 1 million something, 1,600,000. It's not much, but anyway, it's an example that if poor countries can do that, rich countries could do much more. And in this, so there is two sides always, how to get the money and how to spend the money. So in how to spend the money, we explore the best practices. And one of the best practices that we intend to explore that can be replicated in other countries. Of course, there are also microcredit in India and other countries, but we're speaking of Brazilian practices, is the participatory budget fund.
Well, being an academic, I can't resist marking that, and it clearly was outstanding. You must have been a fantastic student, and all I can say is everyone here wishes you growing influence on the world stage. So many thanks indeed.